Welcome back to the Redacted Culture Cast. Today we are talking suppressors, and in order to do so, we wanted to bring on one of the people and one of the companies that has been making waves for more years than they've had the same name. And so, Brett, I typically like guests to introduce themselves, and so here's your chance. Go ahead.
My name is Brett. I cover all of Texas for Huck's Work Suppressors. I've been here for going on about 2 years now.
Awesome. Okay, well, We have just become a sponsored podcast, and so we're going to take a quick break for them, and then we'll get right into the show.
All right.
Now, I'm very excited to announce the first official sponsor of the Redacted Culture Cast. Obsidian Arms is one of those companies that reflects the many facets of gun culture. Not only are their firearms frequently found on competition fields like USPSA and 3-Gun, but they are a Minnesota-based, U.S.-sourced original equipment manufacturer. Obsidian Arms makes their own punch and tool kits for the amateur and professional gunsmith out of Little Canada, Minnesota, that come with a lifetime warranty. Whether it is fine parts that require a Swiss machine, or you're in the design phase and are looking for an American machine shop that is in tune with the needs of gun culture, go check out Obsidian Arms at obsidianarms.com. Thank you. Now back to the show. Alrighty, so where do we begin? How, you said you've been functioning in Texas, but also who is Huck's Works? Who are you there, and give me the story. Give us the story here.
So I came on board with Huck's Works about 2 years ago, right after the finalization of the name change from OSS, which is probably what a lot of people heard back in the day. Some people still don't know we're the same company. I do a lot of demos, a lot of forward facing, interaction with the public. And a lot of people say, I've never heard of you before. Well, we used to be called OSS, and it clicks, and they go, oh, okay, I got you. So, we explained to them the reason behind the name change, Operator Suppressor Systems. Now we are called Huck's Works Safety Company, the safety being a key word in that name. And people oftentimes, well, it's Huck's Works, what does that stand for? It stands for Human Exposure Workshop. A lot of people don't know that. So rebranding as a safety company, the way that we approached, using suppressors on weapon systems beyond just the impact it has on your ears, right? Preserving your hearing, for recreational shooters like myself, all the way to, career shooters, whether it's competition or it's guys that are military, law enforcement, some of these people are doing a million plus rounds in their career or their lifetime or their hobby. And you can imagine shooting unsuppressed that many rounds. It's pretty hard on the human body. I didn't realize it personally. I used to shoot a lot of sporting clay competitions. And, 18, 19 years old, I would go and shoot. And by the end of the day, I just had this pounding headache that would last all day, not realizing that that was from the repetitive concussion of, shooting all day long. And as I've gotten older, I'm sure everybody has a little ringing in their ears, a little bit of tinnitus. It really started hitting home for me that it's not just about ears, but there's a whole lot more that goes into it. So for you, I'm assuming in your career, you've probably shot quite a bit. I imagine you're in the hundreds of thousands of rounds, if not in the million round category.
Yeah, I actually don't know if I've broken the million round mark yet, but if I am, I'm very close. Now it depends. Here's the real question. Does a Flechette Gustav round count as one round? Or 50.
I'll take your argument either way, but I'm really more towards the 50. That's kind of the way I would probably choose that one.
It's been 15 years, so yeah, I've spent plenty of time, and then I grew up with firearms in the home, so.
Okay, so how many of those rounds would you say were fired unsuppressed?
I think maybe 10% were fired suppressed.
Okay,
that's being very generous.
That's a whole lot of rounds to shoot unsuppressed. So when you, as a young shooter growing up shooting, I'm assuming you went hunting when you were younger?
Yep.
Birds, squirrels, deer?
Yep. Okay. 22, either a 22 revolver on my hip or a 22 rifle on my back.
Did you always put ear protection on before you shot that gun?
No, and I don't remember otherwise, but I don't think so.
Yeah. I remember growing up, in a deer blind, shooting a 30-06 bolt gun, and I know as a fact I didn't have hearing protection on. So, growing up as a kid, you know, in the 80s, late 80s, it was just kind of assumed that that was part of shooting. You know, nobody really paid any attention to it, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, growing up, the more I shot, the more I realized, hey, I should probably be wearing ear protection. Growing up in firearms and then, you know, kind of transitioning up to where I am at now, you know, it piqued a lot of interest in me in the firearms community. You know, everybody loves ARs, right? It's like building with Legos, you know, and that kind of gets everybody pulled in to a degree, the tech side of it, you know? And my passion for it kind of grew from there. And then I started, you know, trying to research more about suppressors and, you know, up until I guess 15 or so years ago, I realized they were fairly easy to acquire. So I bought my first one. How old were you when you got your first suppressor, the one that you bought personally, not an issued one?
The first one that I bought would have been probably 2019, and I was 29 years old. Yeah, that was my first time I bought one myself.
And how was it? Were you really excited? Were you upset about the weight? What was your feeling? Do you remember?
It was kind of a euphoria in a sense. Not, and I'm not trying to make it sound way too big, but it was, I had used them quite a bit professionally and sort of dragged my feet to go through the process. And then one day, it seemed like my milieu, the people around me, we all kind of clicked and we're like, okay, we're all going to go get cans now. And that's really what happened. Like, I ordered one, a friend of mine ordered one, my father ordered one, some other, and just, it was just like, boop, 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 boop. And that was it. Like, I was not early to the show at all. For a while, I made my general decision based on, well, I'd use this in the military, and then I'd use this in this environment, and I've seen this in this environment. I'm going to go with that one. And then I just walked in, paid for it, and waited. And I think I waited for mine about 8 months. But then as soon as I got my first one, I got a second one. And that was just like 1-2 immediately. 5.56, 9mm done. You know, and now it was nice. It was nice being able to switch it between firearms. So,
and once you start shooting suppressed as a civilian, you know, has it kind of cascaded into when you go to the range, you're kind of like, oh, these uncivilized people over here shooting unsuppressed? Have you kind of become slightly a snob, just a little bit?
Yeah, there probably was a time. And I don't, and I'll admit that in a sense where it wasn't looking down in no. alone, but there's definitely like a before and after. As soon as I had my own, there was like, you know, if I can suppress the gun, I will suppress the gun. Never an option for me to go, or there was never the preference otherwise.
Right. I think that's the general consensus. I feel like people who, you know, have spent the majority of their time shooting unsuppressed and they shoot someone else's for the first time, I do a lot of demos where I get first-time suppressor shooters. Not necessarily first-time shooters, but first-time suppressor shooters.
Yeah.
You know, and a good group of friends of mine who are kind of gun nerds to a degree, the smile that it puts on people's faces is the most rewarding part of my job. When they shoot a suppressed 22 for the first time, whether it's a, you know, a 65, 70-year-old man or a 12-year-old kid, the way they turn and look at you and just like their face lights up, best part. That is undeniably the best part of the job. And, you know, generally the laugh or the giggle, just the, I'm sure the first time you probably shot your own personal suppressor, you shot like, man, this is amazing. You got a big smile on your face. You know, it's like shooting full auto for the first time for a lot of people. It's like, well, this is so cool. And it kind of changes the way you think about shooting.
There are these like points in the gun culture that happen for people. And another one is, ooh, we lost you. Are we there? I got you.
Yep,
back.
I'm here. Dropped off for a minute.
All right, good. There are these points in gun culture that things like first time using night vision, first time using. So, like, my background was Ranger Battalion. In addition to Ranger Battalion, I've worked in various professional capacities before. And to see, you know, like the first time using night vision is a big deal. The first time I shot a suppressor was in the military, and I wasn't exactly impressed. Because I was coming from this mindset of kind of like movies and video games. I had no data. No one prepared me. No one got me ready for it. But it wasn't like I was going to never do it again. It was it was very educational. Like, okay, so we're not using suppressors to be super secret, or using suppressors to not give away our position with a flash. And so there have been key points, or there have been many of these points even in history where it's, there is the entertainment of it, but I think the other side of having, picking up my own suppressor was, oh yeah, this is mine now. I don't need to turn this back into the arms room. This is never going away. It's just mine. And I can put it on this rifle, or I can put it on that rifle, and I don't have to sign it out of the arms room, which is kind of liberating.
So when you came home with that new suppressor, show you how much of a gunner I am, and hopefully I'm not selling myself out here. When you came home with your suppressor, it gets approved, you go pick it up, you come home, you put it on your gun. Do you, and maybe I'm just weird like this, I find I go through moments when I get a new firearm, I end up, watching some kind of action movie, and I go sit on the couch with my firearm, and I just kind of like tinker with the suppressor on and off and play with it. And do you recall what movie it was that you came home and watched and got it out and played with it, or what you were doing when you sat there and just play with it mindlessly just to do it because it was new?
I think I just set it next to me, and then I got on and played a video game with a friend, and we played.
Okay.
It was Ghost Recon Wildlands.
Nice. Okay, so I didn't set myself out too bad. You're kind of in the same vein to a degree.
Yeah, yeah. If I sit down in front of a TV, I'm probably gonna play a video game.
Don't blame you.
It's a personal thing, but it is what it is. Like, I don't watch movies. Movies are for uncivilized people. I read books and just finished Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. So,
well read and well educated.
Well, at least presenting.
Act as if, right?
Yes, to seem not to be.
So we. As suppressor owners, I find that NFA in general owners, you kind of forget where you came from to a degree of what it was like not having them. And, if your fascination with NFA grows into destructive devices or transferable machine guns, you kind of sort of forget what it was like being that new person. Yes. And sometimes it's, you go and open your safe and there's four or five suppressors in there and you're like, hey, this is cool. But it doesn't have that same hit it did when you first got it. And I will say I'm lucky with interacting with the public as much as I do. I get reminded daily of that feeling. And it's pretty awesome. Just the way the general public has received not only our brand, just suppressors in general, the whole ideology behind it is pretty fantastic. I think that the appreciation that the public has for them is it doesn't ever go away. It's very refreshing. I think that, the barrier to entry with either, cost or tax stamps or wait times has been a big, setback or kind of a hold off point for a lot of people. Currently, while we're filming this, approval times are unprecedented right now. We're seeing anywhere from 48 hours to 2 week approval times. And I will tell you, it has had a great impact on the demand for suppressors right now.
Oh, for sure. I've seen it firsthand. I've said very much so. You work with your milieu, your circle, your participation in, let's just call it the suppressor world, which is mm-hmm. very quickly becoming kind of like the formerly known as SBR, now pistol stabilized brace world. That's another example of somewhere where once you take that step, very few people go backwards. Like
right.
I've got, the brace ruling is never going to stick, or is not going to stick successfully without alienating so much of the human population of the United States. But that first kind of entrance into having a braced pistol is a bit of a leap for some people. And then it's normal. And a suppressor is the same way. And so, I can get where you're going that there. What do you think the cause of that is, and how do you think it would change with our generation going forward, because of so many gun owners in our generation, so many of us are like our culture. If you got an AR, it's probably going to be an 11.5 to 12 to 13 inch barrel, maybe a 16. You've probably got a can on it. You probably have a dot on it. Whereas when we grew up, having a red dot on anything AR was, you know, it was very tactical, I guess.
It has changed a lot, and it's really apparent where, let's say you go to a local gun show or to some of these dealer demo events I do where we're open to the public, there's definitely an age gap. You know, you have the older generation that comes in and goes straight to the Kimber table, right? And they want to know all about 1911s, and they are diehard that way. Then you have the, you know, the younger crowd that comes in and their black t-shirts, the white skeletons all over them, you know, that crowd. And they go straight to more, you know, the tactical or tactically inclined genre. You know, growing up, it was, you know, everything had a Woodstock on it as a kid. I remember, you know, there wasn't a lot of polymer. They're just, I mean, you know, Glocks came out. That was a big deal. You know, became more mainstream for people. And now when you look at, you know, the gun culture as it seemed to progress, you know, Woodstocks are mainly on AKs, you know, and we transitioned more to, like you say, red dots. I remember as a kid, you know, my dad coming home and he had just bought as a kid, 16, 15, 16, 17, bought an EOTech, you know, and that was just the 512, the OG one. And that was just mind blowing, you know, this dot that no matter where you put it in the screen, you were going to hit the target. And I was just like, whoa, how does that happen? You know? Mm-hmm. And it seemed like it's slowly progressed. Of course, technology gets better and you know, our involvement in wars, which seem to drive development of technology to a degree, has really pushed that whole space forward. And, you know, it's not only just in optics. You know, I remember a long time ago, if you told somebody you had a 10.5-inch barrel on a 5.56, they'd go, you're crazy. Why? That's too short. You know, and that's kind of sort of become like the bottom end of what's normal. And like you say, you know, we go all the way to the 16, you know, 18-inch, some of the clone guys building their guns out. But, you know, 14.5 pin and weld seemed to be a pretty common thing. And, you know, 10, 12 years ago, that was not really normal. And as you talk about with brace laws changing, you know, back and forth, it seemed like it's driven a lot of people to move more towards that way. But it's been a pretty interesting transition to kind of watch it all, you know, go from when I was younger to where it is now, you know, 2024. There's been a lot of changes.
So if I'm not mistaken, the law in regards to braces hasn't changed at all. It's just the interpretation of...
Correct.
Okay.
At least not Huxwork's official understanding of the law. My understanding is with you. I believe it's just the interpretation that has changed.
Yeah, that's like I haven't seen any legislation particularly on them that was effective, or I haven't personally seen any legislation. It's not like legal advice. It's more like, it's not the law. If somebody just says you can't have it, you have to. There's a process, man.
Correct. I would agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah, and so. There are, so now back to suppressors and how, so suppressors, even in my professional experience, have changed not like drastically from the outside, but definitely on the inside. They're still cans. They're still about 6.5 inches long. They're still about, you know, 1.5 inches in diameter, generally speaking, depending on which model you're working with. So from the outside, they still tend to look the same, but on the inside, they've gotten quite different. And there's another example of this, though, that is that represents the development in the firearms industry, and that is just barrel technology, like how we make our barrels, how accurate they are, how long they last. As I remember, on a deployment, my first deployment, I had a 3 MOA barrel in my M4. Like, that's very substandard today.
Was that a new barrel, or was that a kind of shot up and used barrel?
Well, it wasn't new, but it wasn't the oldest one in the bunch either. So, but it was an older Colt barrel. But that was sort of that kind of 2-ish, 3-ish MOA barrel in the unit that we were in, and in the time it wasn't exactly unusual, but it was, we noticed that everybody became significantly better, more accurate not necessarily better shooters, but let's just say more accurate when we switched from cold uppers to Daniel defense uppers?
So probably what, 14 five barrels with EOTechs on them, aim points on them? What would you have?
Ooh, if I remember correctly, we had 14.5-inch barrels with, that were free-floated using the Daniel Defense RIS-2 barrel or RIS-2 rail. I think they recently did a SOCOM version of it. Daniel Defense recently had like a short sale of a series of cloned SOCOM models. And that's what it was. And the guns on the top, as far as equipment, we typically had a Knight's Armament Suppressor. Behind that, we had an Elcan. No, not an Elcan. I'm sorry. We had a PEC-15 and a M3X. It's an Insight M3X.
Insight.
Yep, flashlight. White light. Both of those were connected to pressure pads. Either one or two, depending on which your preference were. You might have a two-button one or a single button. Behind that, you'd have your... And there was a little bit of user choice, but our choices were pretty much stuck between EOTech, ACOG, sometimes with a doctor sight off to the 45, or an Alcan. And then everything else was just furniture. So you had... If our guys were using an EOTech, they very oftentimes either had the option or they had mounted a flip to side. So,
gotcha.
That was 2010 time frame.
So 2010, if you dig back in your memory that far, and we'll touch briefly on suppressor construction then. About how many rounds in that weapon system could you fire before you kind of had to back up off the gun because gas was just pounding you in the face?
I don't know how many. I don't remember exactly how many, but I do have pictures of either coming home from the range or from times where the rifle was used with just black, like a half black face. It would be like, because you're shouldering your rifle here, and so the opposite side of my face to where the I would be shooting would be black with carbon from gas blowback and TW50 or whatever we were using for a grease or an oil at the time.
And, you know, if you took your weapon system to failure, suppressed versus unsuppressed, did you notice there was a round expectancy where it failed sooner running suppressed?
I did not push anything like that. No, okay. I can't immediately recall pushing the gun to failure. I don't have any immediate recollection of essentially breaking the gun. Yeah.
Okay. How nasty were your mags?
Our mags? I kept mine pretty clean.
Did you?
We were using P mags at the time, and I kept mine pretty clean. In fact, I have one from there, so long as the military doesn't realize that it's trying to confiscate it from me. But I have one from that time frame, and it still functions just fine. But I'm pretty sure... I would like just brush out my mags every once in a while, like once a week, or I'd kind of keep them clean.
And you felt that was probably more needed running suppressed versus unsuppressed, I'm assuming.
Yes. Yeah. For sure. Because you could tell when they were getting sticky and cruddy and just clean them out.
Did you have the same suppressor the majority of the time you were in, or do you change them out every so often?
I didn't have the exact same one during... I'd probably get a new one every training cycle. Like it would be this. I would get a different serial numbered item every cycle, which means about once a year I would, for 1 year I'd be assigned this serial number, and the next year I'd be assigned that serial number, and it was the armor's responsibility to rotate them out, not just between the teams that were using them, but also I'm assuming for maintenance, and so. The one that I deployed with in 2008, or I'm sorry, the one that I deployed with in 2010 was different than the one that I deployed with in 2011, which is different than the one that I deployed with in 2012.
Gotcha. And your overall experience, you know, I'm sure when you used it, it wasn't to enjoy shooting suppress. I'm sure there were other factors at play, but overall your experience shooting suppressed versus unsuppressed. I know you briefly mentioned that, you know, you had it, so you weren't not going to use it. The technology that existed then versus the technology that existed today, would you still go back and pick that canister loyalty because of, you know, the memories with it? Or is it you thought the technology was really good back then? Were there things you would change about it?
If I could go back, and this is not uncommon, but if I could go back, it would be for the cloning nostalgia of that old can, so I could burn the waffles back into my palm. So it wasn't, it, you know, it's not, I didn't have any loyalty to it. I was pretty young. I didn't have any data or really understanding of it. I still remember people at that time arguing whether or not putting a suppressor slows the bullet down or speeds it up. This is, a lot has changed as far as knowledge.
Our data.
You know, a lot of, and just common knowledge. It's, we don't want to forget how far we've come.
And if we briefly, we'll touch on that for just a second. How many people, obviously we have no way of knowing for sure, but when you go on online, if you're on forums or if you're on, you know, Facebook groups or whatnot, and they're, you know, NFA oriented, I find oftentimes there's a whole lot of people that regurgitate information they've read versus sharing from personal experience. And I think that oftentimes that misleads people in the direction they really should be going based on, and this really applies to every product in general, but obviously being involved so much in the suppressor world, you see it a lot, where they offer information or data that they don't really know from firsthand experience. And oftentimes it's fairly inaccurate. And, you know, you talk about how the, you know, gun culture has changed. What effect do you see that having on gun culture?
The internet, the microcosm of gun culture is, in this sense, a reflection of the macro culture. And that is the reflection of anywhere where you can find the internet as a commonality, where to not have a cell phone with access to the internet is unusual today. And that is, we have greater access to information than we have tools for evaluating information. And that's an epistemological problem. It's simply that you've given people, it's not that we've given, that's not even the right answer. All of a sudden people have access to so much information that they have not, their firmware has not yet updated enough to figure out all of the ways, whether they're heuristics like Nicholas Nassim Taleb, or they're rules of, are there like laws of logic, or whether they are argumentation. And so even that experience problem can be challenged by an authoritarian fallacy. It's just, you can't just declare because I saw it, it must be absolutely true. There are some issues in that regard. However, if we put aside the examples where ego is the primary driver in discrepancies in the spread or the declaration of information that's not very useful or even incorrect, if we can put aside ego and make sure and take out all of the examples where it turns out just to be somebody blasting something into the internet because they want to be seen or heard, or they are, or they're just, you know, doing the regurgitation thing for the sake of almost signaling their participation in something, or trying to identify themselves as a expert, so to speak, without revealing the method by which they acquired that information. We push away all the bad examples, which I think many of us come to find out that we've done in the past and we want to grow through. I really look at all of these cases as not just a lack of information. It's not simply an information issue, but also a motive direction. Why would you go onto the internet and say something that you can't validate? Well, we have this in, like, not just desire to quote unquote be right, but also expertise and value and bringing something to the table where we can help out somebody. So I don't know if I completely derailed your question.
No, that was really good. And I'm going to ask in the same vein. What about the people who rest on their credibility, you know, their past experience, not naming any names or really aimed at anyone in particular, but for example, you know, we have a lot of training companies in the gun culture, right? how often do you see people that, you know, rest on saying, oh, well, I spent this many years in, or I was in this group, or I did this, and that's their whole basis of their justification for their knowledge that they offer, to where it really isn't helpful to the gun culture?
They stand out more now than they did in 2015, because in 2015, that was sort of the peak in my observation of the celebrity chasing, where it was, oh, I'm blank X cool guy. And now we make jokes about it. But, and so now it's very easy to identify somebody by resting on their laurels. Very much so.
And what effect do you think, that you being able to pick out people like that, or me being able to do it, do you think that's a generality amongst gun culture? Or do you think that still, it takes people their own individual timeline to be able to understand and pick up on that?
It's expanding. It's definitely, I think it's not necessarily the dominant worldview or dominant approach. I don't think I have the data to make that argument. I can make an anecdotal argument saying that it is an expanding capability. And this, it's more present in certain circles than it is in others. It's more present. Yeah, it's more. You see this in. I see this very often in different environments where you have people who are of that high performing, kind of professional, back in the day cool guy kind of environment, and they come the stark difference between individuals who purely rest on their laurels and those who are there to do the job is quite different. You have people who rest on their experience, or they say, well, I was something. And in part, I think the average individual, I think the people who participate in gun culture can see that a lot better than they did 10 years ago. I think it's a growing capacity in our community.
I'd say that's probably pretty accurate. And I find that it seems as though that we have, to a degree, done a better job at being able to sort of pick them out, you know, as a culture.
Yeah, so the bad actors are a lot easier to identify. It's not that we have a one for one case of it, and it's not that there aren't overzealous pseudo policemen amongst the community that are trying to root out every tooth and claw of deception and corruption. But it's certainly not the same, and it's certainly not as it's certainly easier to identify it, either for myself or for the community, or if somebody's entire identity is something that they haven't, or something that they once were, like it stinks. It smells. It's visible. It's just sometimes it's a little bit more casual. Sometimes there's a sense of compassion towards it. Somebody's getting out of the military and they don't know where to place their identity. But then there's another side to it where it's, that looks like a stolen valor case. I meet more guys who've gotten out of the military or of hat who have some sort of background, who are actively trying not to so much forget about it, but let that chapter close and not let it be their own identity. And we talk to one another. Our community talks to itself on not going alone and not talking to, not isolating yourself. And for veterans and people who have had experiences, not to just live in the past. So I think, despite the language around us about the divisiveness of it, I think we're actually moving in the right direction.
So when you say living in the past, this will kind of catapult us into, you know, that's talking about personalities. Gun culture now, how do you see, I'll just use the term equipment manufacturers, how many of them do you feel really truly innovate every year, try to come up with new technology. And oftentimes, I'm assuming you've been to SHOT Show. Here's a prime example. How many times are you going to SHOT Show and see a solution for a problem that nobody really ever had, right? There's a lot of that. A lot of solutions for problems that weren't really problems. But then you find companies that, you know, bring a product to market and, you know, show it off at SHOT Show or at NRA. And it's like, okay, that's interesting. I never knew that was a problem, but maybe it is a problem.
Sure.
How often do you see, you know, as a culture, as an industry, I'm not looking for like an exact number, but just innovation in a direction that seems to be fruitful versus just solving problems that aren't there?
I'd say every year I've been to SHOT Show, I've found some evidence of there being a problem, a meaningful problem that is solved. We'll make the distinction between a problem that you don't think is a problem versus something that very clearly is. But what I have witnessed is it's oftentimes in inches before it's in miles, and you'll see a small kind of trend of innovation, micro innovation in a certain direction, and then suddenly a spike. Gas piston systems. And gas piston systems is a really good example. Now we've got the Jackal, the BRN-180, the BNT APC-223. We've got the URX by PWS. We've got all of these firearms that are coming to market. Now, what are
they? MCX platform.
The MCX, the MCX Spear. I mean, you just you keep going down the line. The ARIC by Law and the Law Tactical Folder. And so the innovation still comes in things that do not always show their face. Some of them are going to be barrel technology. PSA just launched their M110 clone, their Saber 10 series. It's a
great review, by the way.
Thank you. It's a functioning AR-10 that has about a 1 to 1.25 to 1.5 MOA barrel, depending on ammunition and conditions, that is sub $2,000. It's still, that is an achievement.
Yes.
You have another example of it would be Unity having riser height options with flip to center options. Like these aren't, they're not going to blow your mind like the first time you ever witnessed a suppressor, but you see all these different tendrils moving in different directions. Some people are purely chasing a military problem. You've got the Bren 2, which it really does depend how much you focus on where your problems lie. So if your problems are, I don't know where to spend my money, then you're probably not going to find the innovation that you want every year. But if you're trying to fix something, like I want to protect my hearing, I want to be able to see further, I want to be able to see in the dark, I want to be able to see it with a thermal vision, I want to be able to communicate better off-grid, you can find solutions. The issue with innovation in the firearms industry from the common user, by my assessment, is not so much that they don't have innovation, is that the conversation on and the way that they frame their objectives is a little bit less solid than the things that we work with.
Okay, very well said. I would agree with pretty much all that. I will say that some of those things, you know, it's here's a shout out to the clone guys, you know, looking at, let's say, the Gordon Carbine, right? Having a carry handle mounted red dot. Well, here we are back again with, you know, risers for our red dots. It kind of like it comes full circle to a degree, but with some type of innovation accompanying it, right? You know, there weren't flip up magnifiers back then, clearly.
Yep.
So when you talk about the innovation aspect of it, you know, oftentimes it comes in, micro changes, right? And sometimes the first, you know, one or two iterations of it don't really catch, right? The idea is there. It's like, okay, this is an innovative idea. The product is catching up. That would be OSS. That would be pre-Huxworks, right? Before the name change. That was, 15 and change-ish years ago. I would say, 12 years ago. No, more than that. Somewhere in that realm. I remember seeing my first, I would say it was a Gen 1 OSS can multi-piece reflex style, very, very long. You know, and I remember it being on a display in a gun store that I went in frequently. I had never heard of him before. I didn't know who OSS was, but there's this work of art, you know, almost internal jet engine part looking item on the shelf. And it's like, what is this madness? What is this thing? Mm-hmm. You know, and somebody says, well, this is a new suppressor. It's, you know, made by a company called OSS. The design is to, you know, push all the excess gas forward. And at the time, I guess it had been more than 15 years ago. I didn't own any suppressors. You know, I was just about to buy my first one, first two, actually. And I thought, that's pretty amazing. And the price point at that time kind of scared me away, because here's this new venture into NFA with a pretty steep price tag at that age. You know, and fast forward now, that I think there's certain people that maybe the idea of flow through technology might be misunderstood or slightly lost on them, whether it's from experience, you know, shooting suppressed, not shooting much at all. You know, there's a lot of things in our life that we accept, oh, this is just how this act is. We just always thought, this is how shooting suppressed is. It's just gassier. You just deal with it. You tune a gun, you know, gas blocks, buffer weights, buffer springs, you know, adjustable bolt carrier groups. You know, there's a whole slew of things to try to solve that issue. And it was just a product when it launched that was innovative in a way. It just needed some fine tuning. It needed some slight changes. It needed a better direction of more health driven data direction. I think that's where the big change happened.
Yeah. OSS, if nothing, was an esoteric company.
Yeah.
That's probably the way I'd have to describe them. Oh, that's the fancy weird suppressor.
Yeah, that's really very accurate.
That's always like it had that very spiny front end, and it was it was different. But we've come a long way there, and the representation of suppressors in popular media is oftentimes the way that people get introduced to the idea of it. However, the purpose of a suppressor is not just to reduce some of the sound or alter the way that the sound is perceived by not only the shooter, but what the target may be. We also know that first round pop and reducing that flash is a major component to it. Reducing your flash signature, especially for people who are using them at night. But the health side of it, I think the health side of it is the newest evolution. Not even evolution. This becomes common knowledge. Something becomes common knowledge. It's no longer new. It's no longer top of mind, so to speak. It's taken for normal. Okay, well, people get suppressors because they want to reduce flash and they want to reduce sound. Okay, but then there's another reason for it, and that's the story of HuxWorks right now.
It is. No, you're very accurate. So it. You know, again, speaking back to experience and my journey in suppressors, kind of leading into the explanation of HuxWorks, you know, my first two cans I ever bought were a 30 cal can and a 22 can. And, you know, someone told me a long time ago, you know, when you buy your first one, you buy two, because you're going to get your first one and they go, why do you only buy one? I got to wait 9 months all over again, right? That's, you know, right now wait times aren't that what they were at a time. And, you know, I was so excited to have them, and I still have them to this day. That I think that my appreciation for the ability to now shoot suppressed, and for me, you know, pigs and deer and squirrels and steel targets aren't shooting back at me, right? So, you know, maybe my justification for them are different than people who would use them on a professional basis, right?
Sure.
You know, for me, I was so excited, so overjoyed that, you know, I kind of reached this, you know, move past putting red anodized parts on my ARs, and I've kind of grown up a little bit. So, you know, now I'm kind of in the big boy leagues to a degree. You know, it makes you feel special. You've got something that takes a lot of extra work and time and patience to be able to achieve. So that in of itself was special. But then having these items, it's like, I have to carry paperwork around to prove that I can legally own these. Like, you know, in your mind, it's a big deal. It feels really special.
Yeah.
And you kind of, I guess, just adjusted to, well, these are some of the byproducts of shooting suppressed. This is just kind of how the process is. you know, and again, I wasn't, you know, doing mag dumps back to back to back, you know, where my health was a big concern at the time. But always following the change in suppressor technology and the different brands and the ones that have come and gone and come back again. And the technology, you know, we move into 3D printing. That's getting more and more common now. And, you know, there's a lot of shapes that you can 3D print that you cannot CNC machine. Tooling can't fit in those small crevices. So for us, part of the innovation, part of the change was really multifaceted from not just a health standpoint, but also looking at the manufacturing process standpoint, and then finding a way to break that down to the public where it was, I don't want to say understandable because the public isn't stupid, but you know, where it clicked, it made sense to everyone, whether you had shot suppressed or not, try to break it down at the most base level of understanding why we did this, right? Like, are you solving a problem that doesn't exist? Well, let me explain to you why it does exist, right? Mm-hmm. We've become so used to shooting suppressed, those of us that do it regularly, you know, whether, you know, on the commercial side or the LE mill side, we do it so often that, you know, we probably became used to it. And I will tell you, the first time I ever shot, at the time, it was still branded OSS, Huxworks, but the HXQD line, which has all been retired, I mean, it's a night and day difference. And it's, I can't tell how many demos I've been to where people say, is there really a difference? And I'll say, look, I'll tell you yes, but here's a gun, here's ammo, here's a can, go shoot it. You come back and tell me what you think. And every single time somebody goes, man, that is a very different experience than from what I'm used to.
But what is the difference in the experience and where does that come from?
So when you look at the research and development that's gone into this, you know, having an actual doctor on staff, you know, that goes through and breaks down the health effects. Imagine taking we'll just pick the AR platform, any gas gun really, but the AR platform is the most common, I feel like. And let's say you create this, you know, glass box that you put the AR inside of, right? And you let just the muzzle stick out of the box. And you put air filtration in there. So whenever the weapon is discharged, that filter picks up all the particles and residue that come out of the injection port, right? So you've eliminated everything coming out of the muzzle. It goes forward. It doesn't get caught in this box, which the box essentially represents the shooter, right? And what they're breathing in or what their eyes are getting hit with. And you measure, you know, parts per million of heavy metal or toxic gases, you know, residue that's captured on the inside of this box or in the filter. And you go through the iteration of suppressor technology, you know, from way back in the day. Obviously, you know, baffle type suppressors are the most common. That's the majority of suppressor manufacturers or, you know, baffle type. You see a difference in progression of suppressors, obviously from, you know, old technology, the modern stuff, even in baffle type, there is a progression in gas flow, right? Or reduction of sound. But when you start looking at flow through technology that, you know, we have pioneered and you start measuring it in this box, you start looking at the reduction of gases and the reduction of heavy metal that's caught in this filtration system in this box. It's shocking. It's a whole lot less, you know, media captured in this box versus what you would on traditional baffle type. And, you know, we haven't even touched on reliability of the weapon system yet, right? So we're just looking at the health of the shooter, not the health of the weapon system itself. You know, we'll say the health of the weapon system.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, and, you know, when you look at small things like, you know, part of your followers, you know, probably shoot with nods on or night vision, or you have, I'm sure, you know, you right. Shoot with a baseball cap on or a boonie hat or something that, you know, when you're firing your gun, you're kind of getting gases trapped up in this general area, whether it's, you know, between you and your night vision or up under your glasses or under your hat, and just kind of lingers there. You know, taking all that into account or shooting in confined spaces regularly, there's a lot that really goes into the health of the end user that is operating this weapon system.
Yeah, I first started hearing about dudes going to SFAWIC, which is Special Forces training for oftentimes heavily centered on CQB. As far as as long as I'm not missing it with or mistaking the name with something else, because I'm not a Green Beret. But the issue that they were running into, they were discovering, and I remember hearing this maybe 2016, maybe 2017, was that dudes who are working in a CQB training environment day in and day out were starting to have serious health issues regarding lead in their system and exposure to gases. And this made me chuckle because I was like, oh, I remember when I did blank and we just muscled through it. And now I'm in my 30s and wondering, was that the best choice?
Yeah, there's a lot of those moments, you know, how many times I, you know, was with my dad in the garage and he was welding and I really didn't always have a welding hood on or protective eyewear on, you know, how many times I got art burn. You're like, now that I'm older, that kind of hurts a little bit. You know, you realize the effect things like that have as you get older. And, you know, you've always got the crowd with the mindset of, man, I'm not worried about it. I'll be fine. It's kind of, you know, you say muscle through it, right? You, whether it's just from not knowing or just, you know, being hard headed, you know, there's always that kind of genre.
And to be fair, my grandfather fought in World War II and Korea and didn't have ear pro. And he was shooting an M1 Garand. So there is this sort of story where you're like, oh yeah, back in the day, men were hard. And I get the, it's not an argument. I just get the rhetoric and it's, I get it, but.
That is, I will tell you, that generation was built different. I mean, to a degree, you know, it's, I think it was, and that's to their credit. That's not a negative. That's a positive for them. You know, there was just expectations of what you had to do and they just did it. You know, there was not a lot of, you know, consideration for how comfortable they were in the process. They just knew this was the end goal. We have to achieve it. And they did so, you know, and looking at that, well, that's a pretty bold claim while being true. You know, we as a society have learned that while the human body is capable of doing those things, what is the quality of life after doing those things, right? And you have to find that balance.
Yeah. No, for sure. For sure. So going back to suppressors once again, mm-hmm. there's the cultural side to it. There's the cultural that has let's just call it the normalization, right? Even in, we've seen this codified in our law that, you know, if a firearm is considered in common use, then Congress cannot legislate on it the same. They can only, you see this conversation go back and forth within the political and ethical sphere about whether or not a firearm is or is not in common use, whether it is or is not regularly used for criminal activity, or whether or not that has any relevance over it. Suppressors themselves have, if we move the fringe of like the only thing that I can understand about a suppressor is it makes it movie quiet and only evil people own it. Like, we have to kind of push that away because it's not really an argument that we're making. It's just the normalization of it. Almost everyone that I know, that's in gun culture has a suppressor right now. Maybe it's at least no longer 10%. So like, if I go to the range with somebody and they show up with a suppressed rifle, it's not unusual. I'm not like, oh, cool, that's strange. I'm more or less now at the game of, how do you like it? How do you like it with your build? Does it work the way that you want it to? As opposed to it being a novelty.
So there's two ways that I could respond to that. Mm-hmm. One goes back to the conversation we had where you get your first suppressor, you know, and the excitement that ensues versus when you're on five or six, you open your safe up, you're like, yeah, it's cool, those are there. I'm still excited about them, but you're not like, you know, fanboying out over them, you know? So for you, going to the range, that may be your, and I fall in this category too, because I forget sometimes, we see them every day, you know, in our eyes, maybe it doesn't have the same effect, but if you look at the, you know, you're at the range, indoor, outdoor range, how many other people there are not shooting suppressed? And how much attention do they pay to you shooting suppressed, or the guy that you were, you know, mentioning, theoretically him shooting suppressed? You know, for them, I think there's still a fair amount of people that don't see it as an everyday normality. With that said, and I said, I can make this argument both ways. I've had a number of 20-year-olds at these demos that say, hey, man, my birthday's in 2 months. I've already picked out the can I want. This is the day I turn 21. I'm buying it. I'm submitting paperwork. You know, and when I was 21, that was the last thing in my mind. You know, so it, I think that argument can go both ways. And I think it's, I don't know that it's so much a geographical within the United States thing, or if it's, you know, your where your political views are based, maybe just how you're raised, the type of family you're in. I would say that I do think having, you know, the internet being more prolific now than it was, and having social media to a degree has helped normalize it, right? Yeah. I would say it has helped normalize it more than movies have made them seem evil or assassin's tools or, you know what I mean? It was always, you saw them in movies, you thought, oh, well, that's just because, you know, bad people use them. But I think now, to its credit, on small occasions, the internet and social media has somewhat helped it become a normal thing. So I think it kind of goes both ways. Our view, because we're running all the time, you know, you go and buy a red pickup truck, how many red pickup trucks do you start seeing on the street? You know?
Exactly. I'm looking up a... What is the... I can't remember it is, but there's a writing principle, and I don't remember if it's directly been attributed to a name, but if you're going to mention a shotgun in chapter one, it better be fired by chapter four. The reason why I'm bringing that up is it'll come back to me. It'll have to come back.
Okay.
So it'll have to come back to me, right? I have to find it. But go on. Let me see if I can find this while you're going.
So when you talk about gun culture, you know, regardless of where you live in the United States, I mean, some states obviously limit your freedoms, right? I think gun culture to a degree has been helped and has normalized suppressor ownership. Go ahead.
I got it. Chekhov's gun. That's what it was. Chekhov's gun.
Okay.
If you mention a gun in chapter one, it better have fired by chapter four.
And what is the reasoning behind that?
It's a literary rule in that if you take the time to identify and mention an item, then it needs to be a part of the story. It's sort of a tool for trimming down excess material in written works. So if you're going to mention a shotgun, or if you're going to mention a rifle chapter one, it better have fired by chapter four. And you see this in various elements of gun culture, where if we're going to take the time to identify things that, like suppressors or like various pieces of equipment in our community and our culture, then we need to see it reflected in the culture, not just as a item of like status. And so I think that this is not the best explanation of it, but I'll it's not the best explanation of it. But what I see happening is in so much of the culture, it's not like a cry for relevance. It's more the sorting of information again. It's well, having a suppressor is normal for some groups, some parts of the community, some families, some parts of the country. And it's normal in some ways because they're in common use. But the issue that I even lost it as I was trying to put it together. So it's frustrating. It's frustrating when this happens, because it was like, that's what was going on here.
Would common use make them unable to be regulated as much? Is that the point you were driving at?
No, it's not regulated as much. It's that it's the way that we see it in education, and maybe another way of saying it is, I think where I was going at with that is, it's not enough to see suppress. It would not be appropriate in communities to see suppressors as some sort of magical tool. We don't want to mysticize it. And so if you have access to them, and you expand if we are going to talk about and we're going to function with suppressors and we're going to work in this environment, we believe in our values and so on and so forth, it's not a duty, but it's almost an appropriate kind of conviction to be able to bring, essentially in this sense, the good news of suppression to the community. Like, I think there's a sense of almost Dune-like messiah spreading the word of, hey, you can do this now. Let's shoot suppressed. It's better.
Do you have, where you live, do you have gun culture, say, events where a group of guys get together and, you know, whether it's training sessions together or just going to the range and smoking some cigars and shooting, or it's, you know, educational from a manufacturer comes out and does a demo. Do you have much of that?
We host our own. I host.
Okay.
Yeah. So the answer is yes. Some of them are, we host ourselves. Some of them are redacted events. We've got one coming up this weekend, but by the time this is airing, it'll be in the past. But yes, we do. And I'm seeing that happen more. In fact, we just had a conversation with Marcus Singletary of Sky Pirate or of Cloaked Entry Co. And while it's not a gun culture event that they did, it's periphery. They did a thing on, like, they did a public event, a free public event on, that taught classes on surveillance and counter surveillance and urban movement and lock picking and covert entry.
Oh, awesome.
And so that is I want that to happen more. And in order to do that, we host events. We host events like there's a public land cleanup this weekend, and those who want to come to the event, it's free. I mean, just come clean up this public land with us, because I'm out in an area that has Bureau of Land Management land. We clean it up, we shoot some stuff, we go home. It's great. And so
awesome.
That is certainly on the rise, and I think it's coming from the community event, the voluntary community event angle, as opposed to something that maybe 10 years ago was a little bit more focused on the kind of militia talk. It's like, oh, you know, we're going to go train and be ready for the current thing. And it's now, hey, you want to go shoot? You want to go have a good time and learn to do something? Yeah, sure, let's go do it. I think there's a pretty distinct cultural shift in what community events look like.
That's fair. When you have these events that you put on, which sound fantastic, by the way, when you put these events on, you know, what are the personalities, the types of people that generally show up at these events? What's the spectrum of people you see?
At the first one, we had ages 7 to 65, and wow. Families, including young children. And we had some guys who showed up with plates, some guys who never seen night vision before, some guys who showed up with some guys and gals. I mean, we had Americana. We had children, families, adults, those who'd been around for a while, those who were the wizened ones. And so I expect the same turnout. We have a pretty broad spectrum.
Of the people that show up to that event, you know, you have the ones that are always just coming to show up and, you know, do a mag dump through a full auto or two, right? That's what they're, you know, they're there for. But of the people that show up, that participate, that help clean up the community, that then take part in the you know, firearm aspect of it, what do you think their general feeling or thoughts are when they leave that event, you know, as far as the firearm side of it?
I hope that they leave with a sense of being involved in something greater than themselves, and then that we provide items. I provide items that they may not have shot before, so they can get some experience on it. And there's a sense of education, but it's also like I want you to shoot. For example, Flux Defense sent a Raider X over for the next one because they saw what we were doing, and maybe we can do one for them in Utah. But now people's experience with tools is no longer solely through their screen. So the first one we did, it was some people's first time shooting with a thermal optic. It was some people's first time shooting the Jackal by Palmetto State Armory. Or the M110 clone, or the first time shooting suppressed, or the first time using night vision. And so we cleaned up the area and then gave the and then some equipment and firearms for people to shoot for the first time. They'd never, and some of the guys were quite a bit more experienced, where they had many of the same things and they had shot some of the same stuff. And so for them, it was a lot more of their, I get to invest in this community, but that's what I wanted. That's what I want to keep seeing.
So that's really awesome. I think anytime you can find an opportunity, not only to bring people together in community, right, and that aspect of it, also find ways to make your community better, but then educate and be an advocate to the public for oftentimes, unfortunately, a part of life that sometimes is given a bad name for no real reason, you know, is kind of made to be villainized to a degree.
Well, how do you look at education in suppressors? How do you look at education? Because I think there's an important topic here that gets skipped over so many times, and that's why I wanted to approach HuxWorks and you guys specifically, because you were saying you were presenting your devices and your tools as a piece of safety equipment, and so education is oftentimes wrapped up with some sort of expertise worship, and this is where you get if just the metaphorical concept of education is your highest value, then the guy with the most experience or the most badges or tabs or laurels is going to be your king educator. It's not even a philosopher king. You're going to have your argument from authority as a mistake. And so education itself often, I as much as we see this as an affront to our post-Enlightenment worldview morals, education is the grounds where ego is so often run. And so if I'm going to go to the range and educate people, right, now you sound like you're a woke person from 2020 and you're just so smart, not realizing that your room temperature IQ identifies you as one of the dumbest people in the room. And worse, you're so arrogant you can't figure it out. Education isn't just, here's the data, now learn to consume the data. And so I don't want to sit here and bring people to the community event so I can educate them. I don't think our community events are just about education. I think it's more about participation. You can learn without education. It sounds like a contradiction in terms, but that's like, what is the thing about this? What is the safety element about a suppressor that you want somebody to know, not so that they also know the thing, but so that their life is better? What is that?
When you talk about, you know, education, some of the most important aspects of life I learned were through my own screw ups, right? The biggest mistakes that I made, you learn from. And that wasn't somebody, you know, teaching at me or trying to force me to understand something. It was like, hey, I realized this doesn't actually work very well. And that was, you know, some of the most important lessons we take with us are just through our own mistakes. So when I, you know, talk to people about suppressors and as a generality, I offer my experiences, what I've had, you know, to them. I you know, kind of put them out there and say, this is what I've experienced. And I don't list my credentials, right? I don't do it from an authoritative way, as you say, but I say, you know, in my experience, this is what I've had. This is how I felt. This is what I've seen. This is what I've heard. And I oftentimes leave little bits of data in there. I encourage them to go try them. And when they come back, they've essentially pieced all that data together on their own. And I've come to a conclusion. They go, okay, I understand what you meant earlier before I went and, you know, experienced this. Let me ask you more detailed questions. You know, that way it's not, you're not teaching at them. You're allowing them to experience it and kind of form their own ideas, which generally click and they go, okay, I get it now, you know?
Yeah. What's the data behind the name change and the shift from OSS to HuxWorks? What's the data behind that?
So my answer to you might be a little more limited than what you would like. I came on when the name change was really far along in its progression. HuxWorks Safety Company, you know, was the rebrand to, you know, new manufacturing procedures you know, really driving focus of a product to not only sound suppression, but also, you know, overall health of the end user and of the firearm, which we really haven't touched on at all. When you stop focusing on just decibel reduction, while that is a driving factor of suppressors, I mean, it's built in the name, right? Suppression. It's, you know, as you say, signature suppression, right? If it's, you know, flash suppression, sound suppression, there's a lot that goes into it, but it's always a scale, a swinging pendulum effect, where if you go too far in one direction, you create other issues, right? You can focus so much on sound suppression. It might be the quietest suppressor ever, but maybe it's extra flashy, right? Or maybe it's so overgassed, you rip the back end out of your scar, right? I mean, there's always a give and take to every aspect of, you know, modifying something mechanically, right?
Unintended consequences, yes.
Right. You go and put big tires on your truck. Well, now your RPMs are way off and you're chewing through fuel, or you have no acceleration until you re-gear it, right? There's a lot of things that kind of come into it. It's a give and take, as I said, of everything. So, you know, focusing on the give and take of weapons reliability and human health, along with still focusing on sound suppression, flash suppression, signature reduction in its totality, you know, rebranding as a safety company to realize that it just goes beyond the safety of your firearm and the safety of the firearm. It's the safety of the end user. So there's a lot that really goes into it. Now, we've touched briefly on the safety aspect of the end user. You know, we consider these products that we have to be off-body PPE, right? So personal protective equipment. You know, whether you're in construction, you wear a hard hat, or you wear safety glasses when you're working in your wood shop at home, or you wear gloves when you're, you know, mixing up concrete, or, you know, ear pro when you're shooting. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that go into, you know, chemical gloves when you're cleaning your house. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into it that oftentimes maybe people just don't know of the health risks involved with certain things. You know, when you're a kid, when's the first time you touched insulation? Your hands were itchy all day and it was annoying you to death, right? You don't make that mistake twice. So, you know, for us, looking at the effect it has as a byproduct of reducing sound out of a firearm, well, the byproduct is more gas. Okay, well, how do we mitigate that? And also, what does that gas cause exactly? Okay, we realize it causes firearm malfunctions if it's not done properly, but then this increased gas overruns a firearm. Well, all that gas goes somewhere. Well, here's the ejection port of the gun. Here's your face, your nose, your eyes. What does that do? So focusing on what the end user, you know, what the human body sees is a pretty big effect. You know, we can go into the rabbit hole of the legalities of it, right? When we start looking at, you know, how many times have you seen commercials for 3M Ear Pro and lawsuits and all this stuff that went on for a while, right? So, you know, looking at it from a PPE standpoint, people don't want lawsuits. They don't want, you know, 10, 15 years from now, well, all these people have respiratory cancer to some degree, and they tie it back to, you know, the ammonia or hydrogen cyanide or lead levels in the blood or all these things that really come into play with the human body. So it's not that we are just focusing on sound suppression and that's it. It's the whole gambit of things. It's that whole sliding scale, and trying to refine that sliding scale where you really start nitpicking, you know, the smallest of increments of tuning that suppressor to achieve maximum sound suppression, flash reduction, but then achieving firearm system health and human health as well. Yeah. So briefly, we mentioned, I just kind of threw out there, you know, tearing the back end out of your scar. Certain weapon systems by design don't lend well to being suppressed.
I have broken a scar using a suppressor. I've done it before.
So there you go. Scars, Tavors are another one. We're actually the only suppressor that IWI approves to be run on Tavor. A lot of people don't know that. Yeah. So when you look at weapon systems and the way they're designed, you know, I would venture to say that probably 95% of weapon systems that are developed aren't developed with suppression in mind, right? You take certain systems, you know, you start looking at, we go back to Mark 12s or M110s, we start looking at certain things, you know, that was taken to an effect and issued as a complete system, right? Or a complete upper. It was designed to run that way. But the majority of the commercial side, at least, the guns aren't built and tuned and sent out to the end user with the idea of, oh, it's going to run suppressed all the time, right? Would you say that's a fair thing?
Yes, and you, with the free market, the average citizen is going to build whatever they want. No, mm-hmm. There are cases where two ARs are the same, but yeah, no, it doesn't happen much, right? Everyone's got something different. Some people, whether it's complete builds by a specific company, people who have a primary weapon systems and that's their short AR or whatever, or something else where it's your Franken build that is the most expensive bougie parts that you can find, or it's what you put together from a PSA build. There's so much variety, and so you can't build it for one. And I can see that from a performance challenge, because you've got to try to make a can that works on all these different platforms.
And on platforms that weren't originally developed and sent out in their final form to be suppressed. They were sent out to run unsuppressed, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, you'll find certain manufacturers, and I know it's fairly common in the military world, that firearms are sent out from the production line already tuned to be in an adverse situation gas setting, right? They're permanently in that setting. There's no switches that you can change to tune that gas on the majority of them. So they're already really overgassed in the factory to be able to drive that bolt back to run in, you know, extremely carbon built up scenarios or dirt or mud or, you know, whatever you might find yourself in to increase reliability, right? Because the last thing you want is a weapon system sent out for, you know, professional use, we'll say, that isn't reliable. Who wants that? So yeah. When you take into account the fact that I would assume your Colt gun was probably already set up to run in adverse conditions, and you go throw a traditional baffle type suppressor on there, well, now it's as though you've, you know, really cranked the gas up exponentially. And, you know, for you at that moment, reliability was probably your biggest factor. You weren't taking into account the checks that would have to be written to buy new bolts or to buy new buffer weights or new buffer springs or to, you know, trigger pins, anything that comes from the excess wear and tear on that weapon system. You weren't footing the bill for it, right? Your body may have been footing the bill for it at the time, but you weren't footing the bill for the repair of that gun. Mm-hmm. So when you look at a commercial standpoint, you know, even guys that have, you know, completed their military career and either do this as a hobby or they do it professionally for a job after the military, we're the ones writing the checks when these guns break down, right? We're the ones that are writing the checks for the ammo that you have to buy to go to the range and try tuning your gun with a suppressor on it, you know, the extra, you know, five or six boxes you're doing. Well, now, in the back of your mind, you subconsciously question, what's the reliability of this firearm? Will it run without a suppressor on it? If I've tuned it in such a way that it has to live suppressed, well, what happens if I don't have my suppressor? Do I not have a weapon system that's inoperable? I mean, there's this nerd rabbit hole we can go down, right? And we can talk about this for forever. But, you know, if we take the human standpoint out of it and we start looking at weapons reliability and weapons health, you know, we briefly just covered reliability. Let's say what cleaning intervals on your weapon system are required when you're running suppressed on a traditional baffle type suppressor versus unsuppressed or versus a flow through suppressor, right? That we offer. There's a lot that goes into that as well.
Yeah. The maintenance cycle on a Mark 18 that functions suppressed, if I'm not mistaken, is 5,000 rounds. At 5,000 rounds, you start replacing parts. That's not a lot of rounds. Yeah. No, 5,000 rounds is not a lot of rounds. That means twice a year, three times a year in use in the right environments, you're replacing it like every other quarter or every quarter a year. You're replacing bolts and bolt carriers and extractors, and that's a decent amount of stuff to be replacing every quarter, just because the maintenance cycle on a Mark 18 is so short because of the combination of the gassing and the suppressor.
Yeah, so there's a lot that goes into just, you know, the dollar aspect, you know, for you know, government, the bill they were footing, or the dollar aspect of a civilian who wants to buy a weapon and start shooting suppressed. And then you you know, you go into the life expectancy of the suppressor itself. So, I mean, when you start looking at, you know, for example, a suppressor company, Huxworks, there is so many facets, so many angles, so much just data. If you walked into our R&D division, the walls look like something out of Rain Man or Beautiful Mind. It's whiteboards on every square inch, and there are formulas on there that I honestly don't believe anybody knows how to understand, but apparently somebody does. I mean, just the mathematics that go into, you know, the equations of them trying to solve problems to the smallest minutia it's mind blowing. It really, really is. And when you know, go and talk to the guys, the brainchilds behind our constant innovation, you know, I feel like I nerd out pretty hard on this stuff. These guys go to the nth degree. Like, it is, they live and breathe it every moment they're awake. They just, it's like their brains don't ever stop. And so the ideas, the research and development, the, you know, the test samples that we make and the torture tests we put them through, whether it's firing schedules or it's, you know, government contracts that have set expectations, you know, with muzzle flash, with and without night vision on, or, you know, water submersion testing or temperature testing. I mean, there's just, it's an insane amount of data that we could spend days talking about that go into the research and development of our products.
So talk about how a suppressor how a traditional baffle stack suppressor affects an AR-15 platform. And let's be specific about it.
Okay.
Increased pressure means higher impact on the gas key. Mm-hmm. And then let's talk about how a flow through, how a Huxworks or a flow through suppressor will treat it differently, especially with things like adjustable gas blocks and parts. Let's get into the specifics of it. But then let's also pull back a little bit and go back to the human and look at the impact of a suppressor as a piece of safety equipment in the end user's environment. Like, how does it improve your health outside of the suppression and the outside of the noise and the sight reduction?
Okay, so I will speak to all of that and my experience. I'm sure a lot of your listeners may have done this in a professional capacity, so I will have to let them kind of draw their own conclusions from what I'm saying, because I can't speak a lot to that. Take it, for example, the AR-15, like you said, if we're going to suppress that weapon system. On the commercial side, if it's not a contract-driven request to that ridiculous degree of specificity, right, of adverse conditions or gas port sizing or running special ammo, just a general, you know, you go down to your local sporting goods store, or you go to, you know, you go on GunBroker and buy one, you buy just a general AR-15.
Let's use something like a BCM. Like, it's you know, something very standard, right? Sure. AR-15s are, they range in quality, but let's take a very, like, a middle class classic rifle. It's not a JP that's completely designed for competition in that environment or whatever. And we're not talking about something that's a little bit looser, but just a BCM, a Daniel Defense, a Sons of Liberty Gunworks, something that kind of fits in that middle category, middle to, and now what feels like high end. But it's, you know, a guy's using a gun that he spent maybe around $2,000 on, not counting all their parts, but.
So looking at that, at the way the weapon system and the way the AR-15 works, obviously, you know, you pull the trigger, hammer strikes the pin strikes the primer, the round goes off and the bullet travels down the bore, right? The bullet travels on the bore. Gas pressure comes to the gas block, the gas tube, hits the gas key, drives the bolt forward, drives the bolt backwards, unlocking the bolt itself, drives the bolt carrier group backwards. When you put a traditional baffle type suppressor on that weapon system, now, you know, we won't get into the weeds on, you know, how hot of ammo are you running, right? Or how many baffles are in this suppressor, just the generalities. Mm-hmm. Traditional baffle-type suppressors are designed to trap and hold the gas in the suppressor to allow it to cool. That's part of the science of why suppressors work the way they do. any container or any confined space or small space reaches a saturation point, right, where it just can't contain any more of what you're trying to put in it. Okay.
Yep.
And then depending on, you know, how suppressor technology has changed, some baffle designs, you know, aren't as restrictive on, they still restrict gas, but aren't as restrictive as other designs. So the gas might flow a little bit faster through that suppressor. You know, travel through the borehole a little bit faster. But you create little gas barriers, little gas walls inside that suppressor, which we'll speak to point of impact shift here in a little bit. But when you look at a traditional baffle type suppressor, you create little gas pockets inside the suppressor, and you reach a saturation point where that suppressor can't really contain any more gas. So it'll either grow out the hole in the front that the bullet travels through, or it'll come back through the ejection port of the weapon system, right? Mm-hmm. And I said to the injection port, it'll travel back up the barrel into the action. Because as we know, you know, you go and start looking at, you know, PRI gas buster charging handles or Radian SD charging handles, trying to find all the cracks and crevices of an AR that you can seal up to help deal with that gas as being directed back at the end user of the weapon system. So when you create that increase in gas pressure, that creates an increase in bolt velocity. So as we mentioned, for example, the SCAR platform is susceptible to tearing the back end out because you have this large chunk of metal, right, that is somewhat tuned with the spring rate that you have in a weapon system, right, to kind of complement one another. So that large mass of metal takes up a lot of the initial inertia, right, to get that metal moving, chews up a lot of that backwards inertia, and the spring starts to slow that bolt carrier down, right? And it's designed to run with a certain amount of pressure from the round you're firing through it. Now, when you put a suppressor on the front of that weapon system, you've now increased that back pressure, and you start driving that bolt back with a lot more force and energy, and that spring isn't really able to keep up with that. And you can do things like change spring weights or change buffer weights, right?
Yes.
But when you start doing that, you start having reliability issues.
Yeah, so let's not a specific answer, but what's a general percentage, right? So that a traditional baffle stack suppressor adds to the internal pressure on a firearm. And you're not going to get a specific answer, I know, because everything is variety, but we're not talking about like a 400% increase. We're talking about maybe 100, it's going from 100 miles an hour or 100 newtons to like 115 to 120. Or are we talking 150, 175?
Well, we'll speak in percentages. And again, it's I can't give the exact for every situation, right?
No.
But you're seeing, you know, an 80 to 120, 130% increase okay. in bolt velocity. And this depends on the weapon system.
Yes, very much so. So an 80, so you're at least almost doubling your pressure and your bolt velocity.
To a degree, yes. We'll leave some leeway in there, but it's a very large amount, and large is you know how you interpret the use of the word large. I understand.
The reason why I'm bringing this up is I don't know. I'm not looking for a number like it increases exactly 23% or 50%, but we're generally looking at on the high end, it about doubles your you've got a lot more energy moving.
It's a lot more. I can tell you what ours is. It's mm-hmm. as we put math to it, you see a 3 to 4% increase.
Okay.
And bolt velocity with a flow through suppressor on there, which is negligible. I mean, is a very, very, very small amount of okay. bolt velocity increase.
Which then for the person who's buying their own parts, they don't need to spend as much time or spend as much money on replacing internals to meet the difference in that gas and bolt velocity. Okay.
Right. You're not wearing out components as fast, but also you're not having to change out your brand new gun with an adjustable gas block or do heavier buffer weights or buffer springs, where you now start guessing the reliability because you've altered the way this weapon system was designed to operate. Mm-hmm. Essentially, with Huxworks flow through cans on there, the gun doesn't know it's being run suppressed. You do, but the gun doesn't know it's being run suppressed. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially as though you've made no modification to the firearm, but you're achieving and you're gaining all these benefits from running a suppressor on there with a various, you know, yeah. looking at older technology of baffle type, you know, with hardly any of the negatives that come with it. I mean, you look at things like weight added to the end of your gun or length added overall. I mean, there's a trade-off for everything, right? But when we look at reliability of the weapon system, and then, you know, as you say, you want to trickle into the health of the shooter, it's leaps and bounds beyond the older technology.
Okay, so without like this is something that I am familiar with, but it's a nice thing to see that the suppressor itself, the improvement of the suppressor is not exactly in the quote performance of the suppression, but it's on the way that it treats the firearm that it's mounted to.
And the end user, the way it treats the end user. And it's, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So that explains, in a sense, that explains how it's a safety tool for me. Cause it, like, I put this on my gun, it doesn't make my gun break. I mean, that's a simplistic approach to it. So what about the end user? What about the person? What does the person gain from? We know we get less gas exposure. We know we get lead less exposure. We know we get less of these things. But to say less is sort of, how do we take it away from the you have to drink less sugar or eat less sugar in your diet vert to this is what it's to you. It's sapping your bones at this rate. It's pulling this much calcium from your teeth. It's doing this. It's doing this. It's doing this. How do we start moving that way with HuxWorks and a suppressor?
So my knowledge on that, on that far of a scientific level is not as high as let's say the doctor we have on staff, but I will tell you my knowledge of it, what I have gathered, through end user response or the knowledge that I've had or just studying the data on it. Very first event I ever did, I had some guys from Canada come up that were, I want to say like a narcotics task force, something in that realm. And part of their job requirements is they had to have blood work done every so many months, right? Whether it was, you know, blood toxicity based or body performance based, just checking overall health. And he said, you know, he didn't name a brand. I believe it was a Canadian brand suppressor manufacturer. He said, you know, using these suppressors, it's like clockwork. Every 3 months we are taking out of active status. We cannot train. We can't go perform our duties because our lead levels in our blood are too high. And that really hit me for a moment, you know, coming from more of the commercial enthusiast side, not the professional side. I said, wow, okay. I said, have you tried our suppressors? He goes, yeah, we actually placed an order. We got them. We train with them regularly. He goes, we don't ever come out of operational status due to lead levels in our blood anymore. That's not a thing. And that really drove home for me the, you know, I came from an industry previously that was very safety oriented. And hearing them explain that to me, and it was, you know, multiple guys are with them, and just hearing their appreciation for it was a pretty big deal. It hit pretty hard, you know, really driving home the importance of the safety factor of what goes into this. You know, these guys are already doing a dangerous job, right? Why, through their own kit they need to do the job, are we causing a degenerative effect on their safety? Why are we think we're adding a positive, but when you dig into the science, there are some counter effects that are taking place, right? So when you look at the heavy metals and the toxic gases, you know, the ammonia, the hydrogen cyanide, and so on, pretty cancer-causing. They're pretty terrible. The human body is not designed to regularly combat the effects that these toxic gases and heavy metals have on the human body. Most of them being cancer-related. You know, it's everyone thinks that, you know, hey, I'm saving my ears by shooting suppressed. Well, now we jump into, you know, micro concussions, right? Let's jump into guys who are in confined spaces discharging weapons. You know, we recently released a product that it SHOT Show this year. This is going to be 2024 with Genesis Arms for their breaching shotgun. We came out with a 12 gauge suppressor that goes into their breaching shotgun. And it's not designed for the commercial market to be a hearing safe item. There was a lot of R&D done, a lot of science applied to, you know, most people don't think when you walk up to a door, you're, you know, let's say within 2 feet of a large flat surface that's going to radiate every bit of energy back at you, right? All these sound waves coming back, and you look at the effect it has on the human body, that even if you have ear pro on, you can still get a concussion while wearing ear protection. That doesn't stop concussions. So you look at micro concussions that are you know, have an effect on the human body from guys that breach first. That's part of their job as a daily occurrence. You know, so most on the commercial side, we look at suppressors, you say in gun culture, say, oh, I'm just, one, it's a cool guy thing, but two, you know, I'm saving my ears. It's Hollywood quiet. Well, they're quiet. They reduce the felt energy recoil heard energy coming out of the end of your firearm, but you dig into respiratory effects, you know, the effects it has on your eyes being hammered with debris or gases and the cancer there. You look into microconcussions. I mean, it's a massive, massive amount of data that you have to try to compile and then physically tune these items to be able to achieve all those goals that you're trying to counteract from basically having handheld explosions over. You have a 30-round magazine that's full of miniature explosions, and you're not only trying to contain that and energy to put all the force behind that projectile on the barrel accurately, but then how do we reduce the effect that that small explosion has on the human body? So it's just, it's a never-ending rabbit hole you can go down.
I fear, in a sense, from personal experience and otherwise, that there's always a concern that the bureaucracy that you sacrifice your health for will leave you homeless and afraid. This would be like VA and issues like that. But I also think that I'm also bringing it up from how tragic of an experience it would be to see that all of the things that you spent your life doing ultimately costs you more than it's worth. And let me use that as an example. There might be a bit of risk aversion involved around elements of shooting and we'll use motorcycle riding as an there seems to be this never-ending debate about whether or not a motorcycle rider should wear a helmet. And on the one hand, you have a concern for safety, and immediately anyone who's ridden a motorcycle for any length of time can start to recognize that it's a bit bigger of a subject than just a yes or no binary. For example, there are situations where you would absolutely want to wear one. If you're off-roading and you're in a craggy, rocky area, probably a good idea in case you tip over and take a spike to the temple. But there are other situations where it's not so clear. And then there are even questions of, if your primary concern about riding a motorcycle is safety, you might not be interested in riding a motorcycle because it's inherently more dangerous than driving a car. Or whatever. So like the issue of safety can get a little off, can be elevated beyond its appropriate level of a value or a virtue. And yet it has its place, and particularly in something like CQB training is so much more common with the average citizen now, the average civilian. Like, going and training this kind of stuff is normalizing rapidly. And so what you can, the exposure to a traumatic brain injury might be easy to push off onto something like the military, but not everyone has that experience. And then to reduce the amount of concussions an individual experiences in training, which they're doing because they want to take care of their family, might not be a bad thing. I think it's an interesting intersection that we're at in the world. So I know that's not like an emotionally resolving phrase, but the consequences of just muscling through it are not always good consequences. And I've seen that happen on the operations side as well.
You know, I never part of life that I've experienced, but I will tell you that, you know, there are some moments in life where you realize that the opportunities or the opportunity that is in front of you, or the situation placed in front of you, you know, you just kind of have to muscle through parts of life, right? There are certain situations where there's just not another option. Those are moments that are probably some of the most important to learn from, how to avoid being put back in that situation again, right? Just because you've done it. You know, there's a lot of job categories in life where people take pride or try to use the hardships they faced as a badge of how you know, what their, and I'll take a moment to curse, what their badassery level is, right? They'll say, well, I've done something this hard, so that makes me a pretty awesome individual. And I say, okay, you know, you've found some challenging moments in life that, you know, you didn't have any control over, but do you keep putting yourself back into those and doing the same thing over and over again? There's opportunities to learn where you can avoid these difficult moments. You don't always have that opportunity.
There's a difference between a trial by fire and a rite of passage. Two different concepts. They should not be conflated. One may encompass the other, but they're not the same.
So I think that, you know, we you speaking to the military side of it, you know, the tools you were given, the tasks that you were assigned maybe didn't always set you up for success, but with your skill set and your you know, brain power, your mentality, your fortitude going forward, you found a way to always achieve the end goal, right? If you had better tools or had different tools, whether it was technology based or dollar amount based, if you had better opportunities, you know, for better tooling, would you not have taken them if it meant changing not only the outcome in the moment, but your personal body's outcome 10 to 15 years later?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It'll be, to kind of close it off as we tighten it up, how do you think that, what do you see the future of the culture, the firearms culture, when it comes to suppressors? What do you see the future of suppressors in gun culture?
You know, I would like to not start my statement with this. I think that our current legal restrictions have an impact on suppressors, and I wish there weren't any. I wish they weren't regulated. I wish they were a part of everyday life, you know, not only from the safety standpoint, but just from not being such a regulated nation to a degree. I think we're regulated on so many things. Take that out of the equation, right? If we look over that, look over the current fast approval times we have. With fast approval times or without them, it seems as though there has been a constant increase in the intrigue or curiosity, whatever term you want to use, is an increase in hunger for knowledge on the subject. And, you know, I saw this before I was in the industry in an official capacity, just as an enthusiast. The knowledge of them, the commonality of them, the majority of firearms retailers, not necessarily big box, but smaller stores, they're becoming more and more common to see them on the shelf. It may not be as big of a selection that you get to handle or choose from as the firearms on the shelf, but there's always a couple in there that you can look at and play with. And I think that, you know, the firearms industry is a very unique industry in the sense of, I think of every aspect of my life, every hobby I've ever had, it is the most, you have your people who aren't so kind, but the majority of people in this industry seem to be very welcoming. If you show up to an event with a good attitude and you're there to learn, no one has ever judged you for your lack of knowledge. They may judge you for your inability to welcome knowledge, but they've never judged you for your lack of knowledge. And I think that when you have an industry that as a whole operates by those practices, I don't see anything else but growth. And I think the only time that we would have a lack of that is through more regulation or more laws or different interpretations of the law, as we said earlier. But I think the industry as a whole generally is full of really good people, you know, people that come out to your events that maybe aren't so firearms focused, but they want to take the time to better their community. But hey, as a byproduct, maybe I'll get to learn something new from some people that have more knowledge than me. So I think the industry as a whole has good people that help further knowledge. I think we are a industry that is hungry for constant innovation to the point where maybe it's a fault where we try to solve problems that don't really exist, like we mentioned earlier. But I think the suppressor industry is always hungry for innovation, always trying to find ways to achieve what we think the perfect suppressor would be. And, you know, everybody has their own iteration of what perfect is. But I don't see it going anywhere but more mainstream and more shared knowledge than it is currently. It seems like it's a constant growth rate.
Yep. I and one small piece of evidence that is that we're starting to see bet more accurate representation of suppressors in film. So it's a small victory. Well, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for sitting and having this longer conversation on something that's a little bit more technical, but also I appreciate your what you bring to the table on the subject. Thank you for jumping on the show and talking about not only just the introduction to suppressors, but we've covered the culture of it. We've covered some of the health benefits, both, and we've looked at some of the challenges that suppressing a firearm presents as like a problem to be solved by the individual. I want to suppress my firearm, but I don't want to blow out the back of my scar, so to speak. That's going to be taken out of context. But you know, like we've covered a bunch of subjects, and I really appreciate you coming on here. So where can people find you guys? Where do they find HuxWorks? Do you yourself run anything? How are you? Where are you at?
So I'm in Texas. I cover all of Texas. Any HuxWorks event where we'll be at for demonstration, I will be the one there, along with some other people from the crew that generally will fly down to these larger events. HuxWorks.com, on social media as well, HuxWorks on Instagram. You know, if you have viewers that have questions, technical data, you know, trying to source parts or, you know, have any issues, feel free to reach out to our customer service line. Or if you're in an event, find the HuxWorks, you know, representative there and talk to them. If you have questions, you know, ask any kind of data you want. Ask us questions. We are, you know, and I think this goes for majority of suppressor manufacturing industry. We are happy to help. You know, a lot of the reps from other brands that I talk to, you know, we're first and foremost a proponent of suppressor ownership and of the industry. And then we are, you know, employees of the industry as well. But for us, you know, it's sharing that knowledge, the technical data or the passion, the emotional side of it with other people. So, you know, if you see me in an event, feel free to come up and talk about suppressors. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
Awesome, Brett. Well, I look forward to taking you up on that opportunity. I'd like to.
Please do. Absolutely.
You know, maybe we'll do a shoot off or something. Pistols at dawn. So whenever.
Sounds good to me.
Whenever the new, whatever's coming down the pipe. But other than that, thank you for jumping on the Redacted Culture Cast. It's been great to talk to you. So
this was a great experience. And actually, live or not, you were my first podcast. This is pretty awesome.
There you go. Well, everyone's got to be your first. And apparently I am a slut for that. So. Not to be too derogatory. That is what it is. But no, man. So thank you for the conversation. So, in wrapping up, for those who are still listening, this has been the Redacted Culture Cast. We want to bring some intellectual tools to gun culture, so that as you are facing decisions in life, you aren't left with moral and intellectual injuries going forward. It's a bit of a long form project, but thank you for listening. We've had Brad.
Or bodily injuries.
Bodily injuries as well. The main focus on our end is gun culture is going through a generational shift, and of participating. It's the how does the life of the mind in this sense participate in our community? And so
the gun culture needs more people like you. So thank you for what you do.
There are plenty of us out here. I just happen to hopefully be the first addressed, but perhaps I'm just you know. Mom, can we have John Lovell? No, we have John Lovell at home. It's the redemption. So
that's pretty good.
I know, and I say that out of endearing love for the guy. So, but if you want to support the channel, if you want to support us at all, you can head over to redactedllc.com. We've got some merch I don't know if the pre-order will still be open by the time this goes live, but we've got things available there if you want to support us, or you can head over to redactedculture.locals.com. And finally, thank you to Obsidian Arms for sponsoring this project. That being the case, go forth and conquer.